Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Wednesday, July 12th, 2000. In the fireside room this afternoon, we have Gail McCoy. Today we have a continued series, the second in the series, titled Faith versus Fear. Today's individual title is The Search for Social Justice in America, Leveling the Playing Field. Is there hope? Let's take a listen.
Well, today to the second part of the series on social justice, mostly focusing on the nonviolent offending female in our society, and also on prostitution, which is inclusive of males and transgenders. So when we ask what do we mean by leveling the playing field, that basically means that most of the programs that we have today do not really rehabilitate a person in such a way that they can go out into our society today of college-educated, high-tech, trained individuals and compete. So if we don't really prepare individuals to go out there and compete with the world as it is today, they're going to become very disappointed in what happens and lose their resolve to get better, and therefore often relapse because there's really no tools or training given to them. Now, do we have any programs? That's the good news, and that's what I'm going to talk about today. There are some very progressive models in the United States today and Canada. They're not only our programs, but there's other programs as well. Since there's so many programs that are progressive and interesting, I will focus on a few that deal more precisely with our population that we're talking about today. Now, as I had said before, the Genesis House program is going to be presented on Friday, and it will be presented in detail. So I would appreciate it if you hold your specific questions about Genesis House until Friday, because we'll really go into how we develop that and what kind of program it is and how everything works there. I will tell you that Genesis House sees about 4,000 to 5,000 women annually in the city of Chicago. So it's a very large program, but we don't have a large enough residence, which I'll talk about tomorrow as well. There's just one caveat. We were talking yesterday before we began, and I think I might have given a misimpression about foster care and adoption. It is a viable option sometimes, and there are very good foster parents and very good adoptive parents, so I didn't mean to give that impression at all. And we do know with our current systems of psychiatric care and rehabilitation programs that there are some people who won't recover, who will remain incarcerated, and who will not recover from substance abuse for whatever reason. When those people are parents, something does have to happen that helps the children when they are separated from their parents. And the point I was trying to make is that we must be extremely vigilant about who gets the children. And we also must monitor the programs extremely carefully, and we must train foster parents and adoptive parents. So that was the point I was trying to make. It is a risk if you're not really vigilant about who you're putting the children, what hands these children are going to. And our research with our women shows that many of them were abused in foster care homes before they got to us. Now, today I'm going to talk a lot about the nonviolent offender with a high rehabilitation potential. And of course, we could make a philosophical argument that there is no person with higher potential than someone else, that everybody actually has the potential. But for today, we're going to focus on nonviolent offenders. The first program I wanted to talk about, starting with juveniles, because we know people, women, and men in prostitution start out normally in adolescence, is a juvenile justice program, which I know is in Canada. It's in Chicago, it's in San Francisco, and some other types of cities. And we look at restorative justice here also. And what the program is when the juvenile commits a crime against someone, they're brought more into a committee and a panel before the judge. And what happens to that juvenile is community service. The community service entails doing something for the person that he's committed the crime against. Now, he or she. That may be washing the car on a weekly basis, mowing the lawn, cleaning out the garage. But the idea is the offender and the victim must face each other and work out a plan, a mutually agreeable plan. Now, it's a very interesting idea because what happens in the process is they get to know one another. The offender begins probably to feel normally some guilt over what they've done to the individual, and the individual is able to work out their anger towards that person and get to know maybe the circumstances of their childhood and what's driven that person to commit a crime. Beyond that, they're assigned a mentor in the community because often we know juvenile offenders don't have parenting, quality parenting. So the mentor then agrees to take on the juvenile and help them to understand the community and how to become a part of that community and become a good citizen in the community. And this has proven to be a very successful program and really helped turn the lives of the juveniles around, as opposed to what we were talking about, instantly sentencing juveniles as adults and so on and so forth, sort of looking at what happened. And again, it's educational for everybody involved, and it really does change. It helps the victim, and it helps the offender. And these are the kinds of programs that we are talking about today, the things that actually help. The next program I want to talk about is the Johns School program. That program's also in Canada. It was started in San Francisco on the SAGE model. There's no program in the Midwest right now for that, but we're trying to. We have a proposal into the city of Chicago right now to work with the system for that. This model is clearly preferred because it's a method of crime prevention that helps, number one, the people to appreciate the harm that they've imposed on a community. Number two, it helps the individual to make a conscious choice, not an imposed choice, about how not to participate in that behavior again. The goal is to educate, not humiliate. And people talked yesterday about printing men's or customers' pictures in the paper. And that is a form of humiliation, but we also know that may scare the person into not doing it or humiliating the person into not doing it again. But it most probably doesn't really teach the person about where the pathology is or what the problem is or why they're seeking out that kind of behavior. So it's another, again, a punitive measure. So we're looking at the goal of educating, not humiliating, in almost all our programs today. The mission of the Prostitution Offender Program is to, number one, explain to the individual the legal ramifications of getting involved with prostitution. Secondly, they explain to the offender the health risks associated with prostitution. This is normally explained by a nurse who talks to the offenders about sexually transmitted diseases, including HIV, hepatitis, and syphilis. It also talks about the risk that you're bringing to your family and your loved ones if you continue in this type of behavior. The next thing they go into is the effect of prostitution on the women themselves, the prostitutes. This is where former prostitutes present their perspective on street life, and they stress the impact of Johns or customers and the impact that pimps have had upon their lives. Following that presentation, each student or customer that's been arrested is requested to face the presenters and share a few words identifying their thoughts and feelings, how they now feel after they've heard this woman speak and talk about how she feels. So it's a step towards not dehumanizing the women in prostitution, which is a tendency of customers, which again we talked a little bit about last night, from violence to murdering them and that lack of seeing them as worthwhile. This method has proven not only to be helpful for the customers, but helps the women in prostitution find closure. And it can be a very powerful mechanism to heal both parties that were involved in this transaction. The next thing they talk about in the Johns program is the effect of prostitution on the community. Neighborhood groups, business owners, and anyone affected that sees it going on the corner, sees the drug transactions, the prostitution, talk about how it's affecting their families, how it's affecting their children, how the crime is affecting the community. So you get a more community sense of how this crime is affecting everyone. The police then normally talk about the dynamics of pimping and the cycle of prostitution. Information is provided about the relationship between the pimp and the prostitute. It provides an in-depth session about the recruitment of prostitutes, and it focuses on the fact that the average person that is recruited for prostitution is the age of 13 to 14 years old. So people really gain an understanding of what's going on there. It informs the participants or the students that when they're paying prostitutes for sex, they are funding and abetting pimps who prey on the victims who are prostitutes. The final step is behavior modification. Again, and this is when we could look into the issue of sexual addiction and recovery. And that in that way, we have social workers, psychologists, and often psychiatrists who then really deal with the pathology there or the problem. And the key message delivered in this session is that people turn to the service of a prostitute for reasons other than sexual gratification. Underlying problems and inadequacies in their lives are usually real motivators for this type of behavior. Some of the benefits of the program and the goals and the objectives when the program was first modeled, and I must say it's a highly successful program. I believe there's only a 15% recidivism rate in San Francisco for people who have gone, men and women who have gone through this program. These are the perceived benefits. The offender potentially gains education and life experience through the offender program. The community and the business groups are involved in the problem-solving process. And again, I talked about in Chicago, we have a CAPS program, which is community policing, which has been highly successful, where when there's a problem in the community comes together with police to solve the problem instead of this sort of force over them, enforcing, and the citizens aren't involved. And this is, again, progressive law enforcement, and it's worked well in the city of Chicago. And we based a lot of what we do now on San Francisco. Former prostitutes have a possibility, an opportunity to carry through their healing process because they need to heal too. They feel violated. So they can heal and they can begin to forgive people that have hurt them in their lives. Communities and their citizens are the recipients of programs financed through the fees. The people themselves who have been arrested finance this program. So it's at no cost to the community. It's normally a fee that's added on when they're arrested, and they have to pay that fee, and that fee sustains the program. So it's at absolutely no cost to the taxpayer, which is a very good benefit. The information gathered from the attendees at the school is useful in research and policing initiatives. They understand what's going on, where it is going on, so therefore it's more effective to really break into the crime. The offender is spared a criminal record, and there are very decreased court costs. Beyond that, the offender is spared the expense of a lawyer, and it provides opportunities to develop supportive programs for those looking to exit the sex trade. So again, if a woman would be involved at this point, we would talk to the woman about the Genesis House program. So the woman that was also arrested at the crime would then have an opportunity herself to go into rehabilitation. And both parties are treated for the problem. And if you were here yesterday, you might remember that I talked about the fact that the prostitutes are arrested at a ratio of 9 to 1. Against the customers. And that's very discriminatory and really not looking at the fact that it takes both parties to have this transaction, and both parties need some intervention of some kind. So for our purposes, I'm going to move on to the female offender and just talk a little bit so we define prostitution before we go on. The standard definition of prostitution, exchanging sex for money or drugs, might suggest that prostitution is a well-thought-out, conscious decision. It is not. Prostitution is an evolutionary process of learned behaviors. A prostitute's job skills are learned from the environment. Many prostitutes learn at an early age that using their body is a valuable way to gain attention, money, and gifts. These lessons are reinforced by social norms. And if you look around, again, at a Vogue magazine or what you see on a billboard or what you see in movies, this type of using the body for attention and gratification is splattered all across and socially reinforced everywhere. So it's reinforced all the time, everywhere you look. These lessons, there are other social norms, buying drinks to get a date, to put out to get something. These are things that people who are not involved in prostitution do, or women especially learn to do when they're growing up. To maintain a relationship, a man must give them gifts or buy them dinner. This kind of exchange for affection. So our social norms of women's roles and men's roles do reinforce the whole transaction of prostitution. You know, I give you something, I get something in return. Women can be led into prostitution for a number of personal circumstances, and they have one or more of the following characteristics: looking for fun or excitement, perceiving sex as power, having low self-esteem, having been sexually violated, poor job skills, or drug or alcohol addiction. Even that being said, when we think about prostitution, it is for them becomes a job, it becomes a means of support, it can be used to support children, it can be used to pay the rent. It does become a job. Not all prostitution money is spent on drugs or alcohol. Now this is my crew drawing, and I do have an overhead, but I forgot to get it today. This is what I call the umbrella of prostitution. And if you look at the umbrella, I have all these little lines coming out. Sort of one of the reasons a lot of the programs fail for helping people is that they'll focus on one thing. They'll focus on mental health, or they'll focus on substance abuse, or something of that nature. But when you look at the issue of prostitution, we have homelessness as one of the concerns, substance abuse and addictions, incarceration, lack of job skills or education, medical problems, which are highly prevalent because of years of neglect, childhood incest and sexual abuse issues to work out, psychiatric illness, HIV, AIDS, and children in the system. So when you look at the enormity of that, it's really no wonder that a lot of people really don't want to tackle this in programming, because it's much easier to focus on one or two aspects. But if you don't have a comprehensive program that looks at all these things, which is again why most of our programs don't help, you're not going to solve the problem. And all these things must be dealt with. So if we think of women in the criminal justice system in our country, what are some of the themes? What could we sort of talk about as themes? Children. Again, statistic yesterday, 80% of women in criminal justice system have children under the age of 18. You have all of these kids. Children are deeply affected by the incarceration of their mother, and there are very, very few resources to help these children. In fact, in Chicago, there's a group called CLAIM. They're attorneys to help incarcerated women. And in Cook County, they still handcuff and shackle women in labor and then take their baby right away from her. And CLAIM has been fighting this because they think, who in labor is going to run away? You know, you're not going to run down the hall. But it's just one of those sort of throwbacks. In Cook County Jail, for example, it was impossible, even if a woman had soiled her underwear, to get another pair of underwear until it was issued. I mean, this kind of inhumanity, and there have been a lot of people working on these issues, but this was sort of just accepted, this kind of neglect and lack of respect for that human being. And I have worked with some of the women in CLAIM that have been really confronting these issues and how mistreated people are in the system. Still, you'd think I was talking about another country, but I'm not. I'm talking about the United States. Women feel intense guilt and shame about their society's labeling of them as bad mothers. That's another concern. If they haven't been with their children, if they were neglecting their children, in therapy, that's another thing they have to overcome, is that shame and guilt, because everybody says you have to be a good mother. You know, this is a big focus in our society. Women who commit child-related crimes are especially stigmatized, just like men are. We know that they often are the outcasts in when they're incarcerated. Is pedophilia is something where they'll actually be the outcast from the others. Reunification for children is a goal for most women, as I had stated yesterday, and that's often the driving force to rehabilitate themselves, to get back with their children and rehabilitate themselves. Families often care for mothers while they're for children while their mothers are incarcerated, so now you have an extra burden on a family that normally is already stretched to the limit financially. Women need resources and support to successfully reunite with their children. That includes parenting classes. Often, again, we see the cycle where women have not been parented properly. So to reunite with their children, they have to learn to be good parents. And a lot of that goes into trauma survivor therapy and going back into post-traumatic stress syndrome, as we call it, because women in prostitution have been likened to survivors of war. So if that person goes all the way back and looks at their childhood, they then have to reconstruct that and look at how do I then not repeat the mistakes of my parents and become a good parent. What is a good parent? And that alone is a huge issue. If that was the only issue to deal with, that's a huge, huge issue. So what hurts? What hurts the women? And a lot of these things are actually currently being done. Dehumanizing and harmful medical and psychiatric medications. The issue was brought up yesterday of giving just automatically, because there's such poor psychiatric care in institutions, giving people Haldol who don't need it, who aren't hallucinating, who don't need it. Just the 10 minutes that the psychiatrist sees them or the five notes that is read about the person. So many times the wrong medications are prescribed, medical and psychiatric. And when people come into our program, we see it all the time. We cannot figure out why they're on this medication, and we'll find out that they're either drowsy or they're up all night, and it's some medication that they shouldn't even be on that someone's just handed to them when they're incarcerated. They have unnecessary and arbitrary harassment. Our outreach workers have seen women tripped by police when they're getting arrested, pushed, hurt, threatened. There's a disruption of important medications. If you're incarcerated, you can't get your medications. Or when you're discharged, they will not give them to you often. And if you don't have any money, there's no way to get the medications to continue on what you need. So if it's high blood pressure medication, whatever it might be, it's disrupted. So now you put yourself at more health risk again because you're not getting what you need because of this arrest and jumbled up life. There's sexual harassment and abuse, and this is highly prevalent in the Department of Corrections and in the jails in our country. And there's been a lot of uprising lately about male guards frisking females and the kind of abuse that goes on there, and women demanding female guards, but also female guards can be abusive. That doesn't rule it out. But just the exchange of demands of guards to exchange sex for the female inmates, and all this goes on in our systems. And so there are some real exposés going on about this kind of abuse of women in our system, and it's terrible. There are language barriers. A lot of people that are arrested don't speak English, and they don't understand what they're being told, what they're being told to do, and they certainly can't represent themselves, and they get poor legal representation. And I sort of sum up sometimes the American justice system by the person with the most money and the best lawyer wins. So, if you can't even speak the language and you have no money for a lawyer, I think your chances are getting pretty low for any kinds of representation that's fair. There's a stigma to arrest. A lot of people now, as you know, do background checks, do felony checks, all of this kind of thing, before they'll even hire you. If you have a felony on your record, you now have a stigma. And if it's that kind of background check, I was formerly more in healthcare administration, and we always did background. You could not get hired in a hospital if you had a record, period, for any job at all, because even if you're handling medications or a patient or anything, and that's because of liability issues. So they're just going to remove that liability all at once. There's a lack of support in the community. This can be witnessed by trying to find a location, oftentimes, where you can put a rehab home or place for people getting out. Nobody wants it. So I remember talking to an alderman, and he had terrible crime problems in his neighborhood. And he said, yes, yes, I agree. Yes, I agree, but not in my ward. Move it over. And, you know, there's only so many wards you can move it over until the next alderman says, not in my ward. And it's interesting that, I don't know if this is nationally or in Canada as well, but in Chicago, churches, prisons, and recovery homes are zoned the same. because a lot of people don't want churches in their neighborhoods, believe it or not, because of the traffic and the noise and that kind of thing. And I thought, that's pretty funny. I mean, that's an interesting thought, that we're all in the same boat there. There's some kind of irony to that, which I enjoy, actually. You know, maybe we'll call ourselves a church to try and get this new building. Now we're going to look on the positive side. What helps? What really helps, and how do we design programs that help? Relationships with people who care, listen, and can be trusted, much like the Holden community is. Caring people who can be trusted. They aren't out to get anything. They aren't to hurt you. They don't want anything from you. They're just there to be helpful and kind. Relationships with other women who can be supportive role models. You'll often see a lot of peer education, a lot of people who have gone through the recovery process return to the field and try and help others because they've made that journey themselves. And they understand what it took, they understand how to get there, and how difficult it is. It is very difficult. And anyone who makes it through that should be just commended for doing that, because it's a real struggle, because there aren't a lot of support systems out there. A lot of it is really done on the initiative of the person and helpers along the way, but if they don't initiate it and stick to it, they won't make it. It comes from within them, and there's others around that support. Proper assessment and classification. I cannot emphasize this enough, how many people are just misdiagnosed or their problems aren't seen. There's three primary diagnoses we see in incarcerated women. Depression, bipolar illness, which is also called manic depression, and personality disorders. Misdiagnosed all over the place. You know, half the time everybody's depressed or everybody's bipolar. There's also been recent research that shows that people really need to be off drugs and alcohol and everything for a minimum of 2 years before they actually have the diagnosis of bipolar, because you're going through a lot just getting all this out of your system, and you're going to have ups and downs, and but boom, you're bipolar and you're on medication. So they're trying to teach the psychiatrist to hold off on that medication until you're really sure of that diagnosis. The other thing is, you have an addict. So the instant choice isn't throwing medication at a person unless it's really, really necessary. And that's another thing to consider. Is this a medication that's addictive? Is this person going to get addicted to this medication? Beyond that, many people are misdiagnosed and may be HIV positive, may have cardiac problems. There's all kinds of problems that come from substance abuse. And that all needs to be taken care of with quality health care. However, if you're not disabled in this country, substance abuse, as we know, has been taken off in the United States as a disability. So if you're not disabled, which most women who are nonviolent offenders are not, they're able-bodied, you are eligible for virtually no benefits. If you have children or if you're pregnant, you can sometimes get medical benefits. But otherwise, you're just eligible for virtually nothing. So in our case, we have to go to centers that are funded by the government for individuals that don't have any insurance. Often they have to go to Cook County Hospital, and it's not like ER. They have to sit and wait for a really long time. Well, I think they do show the people in the room waiting for blood, but that's actually the norm unless you are bleeding or shot. So I guess that's probably pretty accurate. You sit for a long time there. And oftentimes they just keep rewriting the prescription for the same medication over and over and over and over and over and over, whether or not the person really needs it, because they're overloaded and they're too busy. Now, the good news is, in Chicago we now have a core center, which is something that Rush Presbyterian and Cook County did together. And it's a state-of-the-art center for AIDS and HIV treatment. It's completely free. And it's a research project as well as a treatment project, and it's brand new and it's beautiful. Let's say here that Christy Hefner gave $1 million to this project. So she is a philanthropist in Chicago. Everybody was just out protesting. I don't know if you saw, they named something Hugh Hefner Way in Chicago. He's someone we should name a street after, so there was a big protest out there, all the women. So they wouldn't take the sign down, and one of the women said, well, we'll just come back with cutters later, I guess. But they won't take it down, just snip it off, and we'll have to just keep snipping it off. Because what they do in Chicago, and they may do in other cities, they have honorary streets now. They have the real street and the honorary street. So it's an honorary, and it's off of Michigan. I think it might be Oak Street, one of the major streets off of Michigan Avenue. It is Oak?
It's Oak Street because that's where he had Playboy.
Mansion. Playboy the building. The building.
Right, and so he generated a lot of money in the city of Chicago, and a lot of people felt that he should be honored with them.
Except for feminists.
A lot of money that did go into that.
Well, I think there's other people we can name streets after besides someone who glorifies sleeping with blonde twins that are 21, but we won't go there right now. It's something Genesis House does not support. Let us say that. I mean, you know, there's Mayor Daley Way. I mean, you know, there could be a lot of other people.
In what you've been describing, is there a comprehensive treatment program or option for a sentencing judge? Because I inferred in your comments that there is one for the customers who can fund that. You mentioned jars, and
right.
It sounds like it's a diversion type program.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a similar thing for prostitutes?
We have one of the first ones in the United States in Chicago, which we develop, and we do have that.
Have you talked about that?
No, that's what I'm going to talk about on Friday.
Okay.
But that's, yes, we have. We've developed one of the first ones in the country. We're a national model for a court diversion program with the help of the judges and the police and the public defenders and the city attorneys. We all got together. And we've been, I think Arizona was the last person who was out to see our program and look into that. Well-trained staff, as I was talking about, again, back to what helps, especially female staff. Again, women are more comfortable normally with women, especially if they've been in prostitution. Proper medication. Programs, not just incarceration, job training, education, substance abuse, mental health treatment, inmate-centered program. Ted Koppel showed a program in California that took certain inmates out of the prison population in the female prison, and he showed what it was like to leave the prison without intervention, and it was really interesting. The women got in a bus and they had $250, and they are put, you know, they're given the clothes they were arrested in. If they were prostituting in those clothes, if they were using drugs in those clothes, if they were drunk in those clothes, they're put in a bag, and that's what you put on when you leave. Then you land at the bus stop out there in California with $250 in your pocket, and that's where the drug dealers are waiting for all the women that are coming off the bus from the prison to get that $250. $250, as we all know, is not even, you know, first month's rent. You can't even stay in a hotel very long for that. So normally then they have to return to the place, the person they were living with, or the bad crack house they were in, or wherever they were, because that's it. And that's why they have an 85% recidivism rate. Then he showed a program that was very intensive in case management, took these women, 250 women, out of the population who showed rehab potential. They had case management, they had a place to live, they had money, they had different clothing, they had job training. And from that program, those women only had a 20% recidivism rate. 60% difference in returning to prison. And if you look at just the basics, what's going to happen when a person leaves with their old clothes on at $250? What can possibly happen but going back to the streets? You don't set them up for any type of success whatsoever. So that to me was a very interesting effort, and he's made a number of efforts. He's done some very good programming on the problem of incarcerations in our country. We need efforts to reduce trauma and re-victimization and alternatives to seclusion and restraint. As one of our women talked about yesterday, she really, really was angry. And that's all it did for her, is it made her angry. And a number of them expressed, I was angry. All I wanted to do is go out there and do it again. Or, you know, I was just infuriated because I was thrown in with criminals and drunks. And it didn't help me a bit. It just motivated me to be angrier and to commit more crimes. They need financial resources, obviously. And they need safe environments. And that is not returning them to the neighborhoods where they once were. Sometimes this means not returning people to their families. Sometimes their families are using drugs. Their mothers are dealing drugs. Their mothers are prostitutes. It's not always, you know, the American ideal. I mean, you have to really reframe things of going back to the family, maybe the absolutely worst thing for that individual. You may have to place them in a completely different environment to start all over in a supportive community of recovering individuals. Some apartment buildings are like that. We have some in Chicago that are run by people that are in recovery, and they allow people in recovery to live there, and the rules are you can't drink and so on and so forth, and recreate recovery communities in apartment buildings. So everyone in there is in recovery and supporting each other, and if you relapse, you have to leave the apartment, which is I think, a very good idea. So today, if we were going to form this sort of comprehensive treatment program for women, we would address the following issues: the etiology of addiction, especially gender-specific issues relating to addiction. That includes social, psychological, physiological consequences of addiction. I've talked about heart, what happens to the heart, what happens to the blood pressure, what happens to the teeth. I mean, drug abuse damages people in so many ways, and it takes health care and medical care to get them well again. We look very hard at the issue of low self-esteem, which is basically how people get there to begin with. That's sort of the number one common denominator in the population. We have to look at race and cultural issues because people are different. An example in Chicago, Hispanic women in prostitution work very differently from African-American women in prostitution, and Asians work completely differently. Asians are never out on the street. They're almost always in brothels. Hispanic women work in bars and laundromats, and when they're arrested, they will unequivocally say, I was not doing that. They never will admit it. So, you know, it's very interesting. So we have to hire all kinds of different cultures who can, in fact, our Hispanic outreach worker said, well, what I figured out is we're going to have to go into the bathrooms at the bars and talk to them in there, because you can't even be out in the bar because they're not going to admit to the fact that that's what they're doing. So there's all these cultural things, and unless you can't just have across the board broad brush programs. You have to really start to look at how do we do this. In the case of brothels, you have to have undercover people coming in that speak the language and of the culture. Because in Chicago, we have a lot of Eastern European brothels. We have the largest Polish community in Chicago besides Warsaw, I think. It's the largest population. So how do you know? You're not going to know what that is. They're not going to be out on the corner. You have to figure that out and infiltrate that. And often in the brothels, as I was saying yesterday, is where the underage prostitutes are hidden, because they are not normally going to be out on the streets unless they're runaways. And then that's different. And we have programming to intervene with runaways. We look at gender discrimination and harassment, which I think I've talked about enough and don't really have to repeat. But certainly in prostitution, that is a key issue. Discrimination against women and gender harassment, and it goes on into the Department of Corrections in this country. Women are just not protected in the Department of Corrections. Disability-related issues where relevant. Some of the women are mentally ill. Some are disabled from medical, physical problems, so they need to get their disability, they need to get their insurance and so on, and then they need to get into job placement programs, and they can be placed through the proper programming. Many, many people hire, and there's a lot of partnering programs where the employer will pay half and the organization will pay half so that the person can become employed and feel good about themselves and have a gainful employment. The big thing that has to be worked on, and it's always one of the most difficult, is attachments to unhealthy interpersonal relationships. We did a trauma survivor. I had studied with women who had gone, they're called Woman Care in Evanston. And they're very, very well known on trauma survivor. They've gone to South Africa and they've worked with victims of apartheid. And I went back because our residential director wasn't there, so I thought, well, I'd like to do a trauma survivor workshop with the women. Every woman had a different story. But at some point, about late teens, because she wasn't getting her needs met in the family, or she was actually being abused in her family, or she was not even with her family, she'd been pawned off on some relative, there was some person, and this, whether or not it was a homosexual relationship or a heterosexual relationship, some person that entered her life and said, started telling her what she wanted to hear. You know, either she was pretty or she was sexy or she was smart, something. And 9 times out of 10, this was a bad relationship. You know, because this person was like a walking target. You know, just be minimally nice to me and I'll do anything for you. And people who are cruel, who are manipulators, prey on that kind of young person who has victim written all over them. And they know just what buttons to push to manipulate this person. And they all had the same story. And that is a continuing pattern. I mean, we can label it codependence. We can label it there's all kinds of dysfunctional relationships. But that is one of the biggest battles, because of that neediness and that low self-esteem, they allow themselves to be abused. And that goes across, you know, the lines with domestic violence and a lot of other issues. But it's the same theme. And to break that and to teach people to develop healthy relationships is a very big challenge. Because people, let's face it, people who are users are looking for that person. And they know how to size them up and use them. And that's what happens. So we have to teach them to totally reject unhealthy relationships. And it's a battle, because basically most of the time they haven't had any really healthy relationships in their lives. They don't know what they look like, sound like, or feel like. So that's a battle. And that's why we provide a lot of role modeling. In our program, we have men come in who provide positive role modeling as volunteers. Jesuits come in, all kinds of different men who will be positive role models so the women can relate to them in a positive and see what a good person looks like, you know, as opposed to someone who's out to use you for some reason. We have to look at eating disorders. We see a lot of eating disorders in our program. Most recently, we had someone who was a sleepwalker and who ate in her sleep. And therapeutically, you might say normally that she'd probably been abused a lot at night and had to be vigilant at night. And she was not diagnosed in the previous program she was in, which I had mentioned yesterday. But you do see a lot of eating disorders because of different, you know, the way they see their body and things like that. Or if you're getting off drugs and alcohol, then you want to sort of do something if you've been addicted. So eating disorders is a big problem. We had someone with bulimia too about a couple months ago. I mean, it's very, very frequent. It's almost always. We have to look at sexuality, including sexual functioning and sexual orientation. What is healthy sexuality? I mean, everyone strives for healthy relationships and healthy love and healthy interactions with someone, a partner. So what does healthy sexuality look like? What do healthy relationships look like? We have a partnership with an organization that comes in. It's called Howard Brown. And they actually teach the women all about their bodies, about breast cancer, about sexually trans. Oftentimes, they don't know those things. So we teach how do we look at our body? How do we examine ourselves? And what is a healthy relationship? All about healthy sexuality and sexual health. And again, as I've mentioned before, parenting is key. And we look at grief, because often there's grief related to the loss of alcohol, drugs, children, family members, or partners. Oftentimes, if this woman or this man is going to survive, they cannot go back to the people they've been with. So what you need to realize, they lose a whole community. If you lost your whole community overnight, that'd be pretty lonely. all the people she might have been dealing with were substance abusers, or they were customers. Some of them have long-term relationships with customers, that frequent customers that come back, may give them extra money. So they're losing all that. And one of the replacements for that community is the church, because the church is a community that can replace the negative community. And often, many, many of our women turn to the church community because there's a place they'll be welcome, they'll fit in, it's healthy, there's a place to go, there's programs to be in. So the church community becomes a big replacement, as does the 12-step community for our women. And we really promote replacement of community and healthy community. And the women in the program become community. They become sisters. The graduates come back. Work. We encourage everyone to work. The odd thing is, most people would think that they don't want to work. You know, you get that discriminatory prejudice, but actually we have to hold the women back from work, and we do not allow them to work, which always surprised people. The reason being that the women have all worked. If you did their bios, they could say, well, I've had 14 jobs, I've had 18 jobs. The issue is not, can you go to McDonald's tomorrow and get a job? They all can. The issue is, why do you lose your job and start spending your paycheck on drugs and alcohol and eventually get into prostitution? That's the issue. And again, the mentality in the United States is, get a job right away, get a job. You know, and it's ridiculous. We will not let them work for 6 months until they really figure out what their issues are. They start on their therapy, they start, and you know, their treatment, their psychiatric treatment, their counseling, their 12-step, their GED, whatever it might be, and then we have to approve the job. And we've pulled people out of jobs if it was an inappropriate job. We found out there was something, you know, maybe the population who came in was drunk or they were nightclubbing or whatever it is, and we'll pull her out of that job and say, it's just inappropriate for you. And there are too many triggers, as they say in addictions. You know, this, you know, these people are coming out, and you know, it's not going to be good for you to stand there and watch that and try and stay sober. So we're very picky about it, and sometimes our women don't understand it, but there's a reason. Virtually all our women get jobs when they leave our program, and they want jobs. So that's what we work on. We look at appearance and overall health and hygiene, appropriate dress, appropriate makeup, what is our appearance, what is our hygiene, and just look at that and monitor that. There's a sense of isolation that they have related to a lack of support systems, which often includes family members and partners. Partners were probably many times destructive and not good for them, so there's a lot of isolation felt, and that needs to be dealt with. We also have to look at life plan development. Now that you're on this new road and all of this is now gone, what is your life plan? And that can be very perplexing. You know, where are you going? What are your goals? And that's scary to finally kind of look at that and be sober and say, where am I going? What are my plans? And the last thing we look at is child care and custody. And that is, if your kids have not been adopted, what are the steps to get your children back to you? So basically, that's my presentation. And I had only really one question, and then I would welcome your questions. But I was thinking, as I was looking at some of the research, does anyone think that drugs should be legalized in the United States? And the money that is spent on arresting people and incarcerating people would be better spent on treatment programs and helping people to get well, since it appears that drugs are coming into our country routinely and at an alarming rate. And it seems that there's really no way to actually stop that, because there's also drugs that could be manufactured in people's garages, as we know. So what do people think?
Why would it be necessary to legalize drugs in order to change what happens to the offender to being put into treatment rather than into prison?
Mm-hmm. It's just, I mean, people have proposed it. Well, I think that if you legalize drugs, it's no longer a crime, so you don't waste all the money arresting people, you know, picking up people, incarcerating people. It's not illegal to use drugs. You know, you offer treatment to them. Just like it's not illegal to use alcohol, sort of a similar idea that we're in actually prohibition right now for drugs.
I guess where I see the dilemma is not, it, there's kind of this picture I think out there that someone's sitting around in a little communal group snorting coke. Somebody finds out, comes and arrests them. But if you talk to law enforcement officers or a lot of people that are, that's not often what happens. What happens is the drug or the alcohol causes them or is the factor in causing them then to commit another sort of crime for which they're arrested. It's not like, and see, that's where I, you know, deal with the issue of whether you legalize drugs. I don't know that that's what, I think there are cases where people get put in jail for, you know, smoking marijuana and stuff. And so that seems a little clearer cut to me, the marijuana issue. But some of the harder drugs leading to crime, and sometimes to violent crime, I don't know that legalizing it would necessarily, because they're not being arrested because they took the coke, they're being arrested because of what the behavior was.
They shot the dealer.
Yeah. In that case, I'm not sure it's, you know what I mean? I'm not sure the issue is as clear mm-hmm. as whether we should legalize a drug or not.
Well, Bellerab, whose post was out there, was the chairwoman of the presidential committee under Jimmy Carter that said legalize marijuana. I remember talking to her about that because she was suddenly sacked. And she said it was just politics. It was a good option, but it was politically unpopular. I've been a prosecutor, and I analyzed my caseload for a number of years. Here I have 85 to 90% of my defendants were under the influence of a substance or arrested and charged because of the substance.
Wow.
I know that the federal budget spends more money on prisons than on education at the federal level. I know that prison and gambling is the biggest two growth industries for the state. Mm-hmm. And I believe strongly that if we decriminalized drugs, that it would be socially healthier. The fact that America has always been, in the last 30 years, in the top three nations of incarcerating their citizens per capita goes straight against that concept that we live in a free land. Mm-hmm. But it's politically unpopular, and that's what I listen for, is where has political courage come forward to say decriminalization or treatment is a better option? What I hear resounding throughout this nation in states is that more criminalization, more rules, more penalties, because then we can have a population that's disenfranchised. And for some reason, we must like that, mm-hmm. because we do it.
I agree.
I get off my soapbox.
No, I think that was great. Because you're speaking with authority. I mean, you do this every day, and you can say, this is what I see, and that's just what I'm talking about. That's what's going on, and it's sort of this education of why aren't we seeing it as a country? It's incredibly frustrating.
I'm alcoholic, and I also teach religion to 7th and 8th graders. And when I do a unit on morality in 8th grade, I have a number of topics they can pick. One of them is the legalization of marijuana, and I kept it at marijuana. And when I hear, when they pick that, they can pick or not pick, and sometimes they do pick it, but I found that argument, I live in the state of Washington where liquor is controlled by the state. It's a state, you can only buy hard liquor in a state liquor store. You know, and I would always throw out to the kids, you know, is marijuana more dangerous than alcohol? I have my doubts. And it may be more dangerous because it's illegal, and you're dealing with illegal possession. But I think I'm leaning towards, like you were, towards the legalization, certainly. And if need be, have it sold to, like, the state liquor board in the state of Washington. You know, it's another source of income for the state.
And the tax,
and
yes.
Somehow put the, like, I think that the money from booze somehow should be put back into recovery programs for those who are addicted.
Mm-hmm.
And I certainly believe that alcoholism is in some sense a genetic addiction, because when I was in treatment, they did a thing when they said, how many in here had an alcoholic parent? My hand went up, I had two. How many had an uncle? And by the time they asked within that little family system there, everybody in the room had a hand up because somebody in their family was addicted to alcohol, which makes me tend to think, you know, that's why they didn't sell booze. When I was growing up, you couldn't have booze on an Indian reservation.
Oh.
And in the state of Washington right now, the Yakima Nation is trying to get booze off of their reservation. A large part of the reservation is owned by other people, by, I mean, their land. So it's a real contention there, in the sense that people own the bar, let's say, that's on the reservation, what's going to happen there?
Well, it's interesting that they've done that with cigarettes. That now, because people are addicted to cigarettes, and the cigarettes companies are starting to have to sort of cough up, pardon the pun, for what's been happening. That was really unintentional. When it came out of my mouth, I realized. But you know, it's a good point you make. Why shouldn't liquor companies start to be held, you know, taken to task the way cigarette companies have, tobacco industry?
Or
it's kind of an interesting thing.
The taxes put on, or the money the state makes, at least in the state of Washington, I imagine every state has a state tax, but they have the liquor out of their store here. It seems to me that some of that, I don't know how they fund that. I'm
mm-hmm.
not privy to that.
Well, I can see. I mean, I also think there are a lot of, do you blanket say everything's legal? Probably no, but I think there's certainly, from going, it's from extremes of nothing to everything, I think there'd probably be a lot of things in between that would be more beneficial for society. Because, you know, I've known people in the DEA, agents and so on, and they're just, you know, there's a fraction of what comes in that they actually get. I mean, it's just almost an act in futility, and there's a lot of money going into the DEA.
Legalization is different than decriminalization.
Mm-hmm.
I want to point that out, because decriminalization means we do not have criminal penalties.
Right.
Right. Legalization is more supported, and decriminalization, I hope the segments of that population could embrace, because that would be different. In our Washington state, they've actually now criminalized driving with a suspended license. So you have prison time, you have jail time for that, which often is an economic crime. So there could be a consequence for those who want to bludgeon people, but it would not be criminalization. And when you were mentioning your program, and you mentioned how the impact of an arrest and a conviction, it, you know, keeps them out of the economic mainstream, decriminalization could have a consequence for those who want it, but it's not that criminal. Because I think it's got to be done in progressive steps, but it hasn't happened. I hear courageous politicians who are lame ducks say, you know, we should decriminalize, and I'm out of here.
50, yesterday I was reading that 50 countries, and I don't know how many years ago, like over 20 years ago, voted to decriminalize prostitution. And we're one of the countries, in the United Nations, and we're one of the ones who didn't. And so, same idea, you know, and we support decriminalization, not legalization of prostitution, for the same reasons. We don't want to put a rubber stamp on it and say this is really an okay activity. But yet, why spend all this money in this place? Let's spend it on rehabilitating people.